This is Games as a Podcast.
Hey, Ethan. Good afternoon. How are you?
Oh, I'm great, Chris. And in good part,
except
because
that it's morning.
Right. Yeah. I'm great because we have one of the guests that I've wanted most to have on the show since we started it. And the reason is because I have myself had two dream jobs in my life. One was being a writer at Ziff Davis Media, writing video game reviews. The other was being a creative director at Sega. And there's only one person in the world that has both of those experiences themselves, and that is Jennifer Sow. Jen, welcome to the show.
Oh my God, Ethan, you know how to make people feel good. I never thought about that we both had that experience. You're right.
Yeah. And I just remember when you came on board, I had been in the Chicago area working on Game Now magazine. And there was this dramatic time where the word got out that everyone was moving to California. And apparently, the magazine that I was on, Game Now, was on the bubble. And John Davison had to decide either to bring it over or to just cancel it. And the numbers were not good in our first year. So that was a scary, scary question to have answered. And I was so convinced that we were going to be told our jobs were gone that I had actually packed up my desk the day before we had the big meeting. And then he said, hey, if you want to come to California, you have a job. And so that's how I came over. And I remember you were at MTV before Ziff Davis. Is that right?
Yes. Not directly before, but I was actually at Next Generation.
Right. Okay.
Magazine. My career started at MTV in the 90s as a journalist because I had gone to journalism school, which is a quaint, incredibly quaint notion nowadays.
Well,
journalism is a quaint notion nowadays, but I got a master's at Columbia in New York in journalism. Then I went to work for MTV for a couple years, and that was amazing and great. But I came out to California in the late 90s because I was like, I heard about this thing called the internet. And as I like to say, it is my elevator pitch for my career is, I heard that secretaries were becoming millionaires out there in California. And I was like, I got to get back there. I mean, I grew up here and I'm from here. So I was like, that sounds good. So I ditched my media career and came out here. And I started working in tech during the dot-com bubble. And that's a long story. I mean, it ends with a happy ending for me. But after the dot-com bust, I was like, let's reevaluate. And I was able to get a job at that point at Next Generation, which was Imagine, became Future Publishing, as the managing editor there. And I had a great, like, year and a half until Next Gen really tragically, I mean, so your Game Now experience, I mean, this is what it's like to work at a gaming magazine. You're kind of constantly worried about it going out of business. And
yeah,
December 1st, 2001 was the day we all got called in to the office there. And I was let go from there. And then I was unemployed for a year, maybe. And we got this, and then we got rumblings, you know, like rumblings in the East of, I had heard rumors. People were like, EGM is moving to San Francisco. And like, you'd hear this, and people like, OPM, and, you know, all these. And
let's unpack the alphabet soup for those who might not know. So EGM was Electronic Gaming Monthly. OPM was Official PlayStation Magazine. There's also XBN, which was Xbox Nation at the time. GMR, GMR, which was Gamer Magazine.
CGW,
which was kind of the flagship for a long time. Computer Gaming World. I remember when we had an honest conversation with a guy named Dale Strang, who you probably remember, the publisher there. He was giving us assurances that Game Now was fine, which at the time it was. And he says, look, I'd tell you if it wasn't, and I'm willing to kill anything I have to. I remember him saying, I'd shoot CGW in the head if I had to, but we're not there, so don't worry about it.
You know, accurate. I mean, that's how it was. It was brutal. It was brutal industry, you know?
Yeah, it's fine until it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. So I definitely remember not even believing that. Cause like, I was really desperate. I think anyone who was living in the Bay Area around 2001, who had been in tech in any form, like those were desperate, desperate times. Like there were no jobs. It's hard to believe now, but like my now husband, then boyfriend, he was out of work even longer. Like 2 years or something. It was hard. And so to hear that these magazines were coming from, because we always knew you guys, because we'd see you at events and stuff. Yep. Like I think I knew Crispin. I definitely knew Shu. I don't think I had met you. I feel like I knew Seabake. Yep. You know, because we would see each other at events and kind of get to know. We were competitive, but like it was friendly competition, Frenemies. You know.
Which yeah, people on the outside didn't think that was the case. I remember so often hearing, oh, you must hate Game Informer and you must hate GamePro. And it's like, no, we're all buddies. We all go to the same bracket.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, not. Like our crew at Future/Imagine, that was like Chris Charla, Blake Fisher, yep. Tom Russo, like
Mike Micah.
Mike Micah, Aaron Loeb, like these people were all like, the whole game magazine publishing group. It's a rough and tumble group, right?
For me
as a woman, I will say Future was a very like harsh environment. Also the managing editor role there was really different. So
yeah.
The managing editor was like a copy editor only.
Right.
And basically a production person, and like the idea of writing reviews or writing anything at all. Most of the managing editors were women, not coincidental at all, you know, and our roles were very limited.
Yeah.
Like intentionally limited. And I don't know if it's intentionally, probably not. Cause I think it was one of the magazines had a male, I think it was PC Gamer, but because I'm old now, I can't remember who that was. Somebody had a male managing editor, and I feel like he wrote. I just remember coming in, and I had been really excited because I was a gamer. And I got there, and I realized, like, they did not want me. They did not want to cultivate me as a gamer or as a writer. Like, they were basically like, you're a copy editor, and that's it. And, like, it was kind of hard to, it was hard to be taken seriously. And I mean, in fairness, I wasn't as hardcore of a gamer as Blake Fisher, you know, like,
sure.
And Tom Russo. Like, I certainly didn't know the level. And I mean, there were some, I remember, like, I did make some errors occasionally in editing that definitely damaged my credibility, you know, where I was like, oh shit, I didn't know. I mean, I still remember those. I'm kind of embarrassed.
Well, okay, but Jen,
I'm too embarrassed to talk about it, but they're in the magazine.
I hope that you'd mention one or two of them. And if it makes you more comfortable, I'm going to share with you a story of me being the worst copy editor in the world, copy editing my own stuff, because I did a preview for a game based on the Two Towers. Because EA had that property and they were making games based on it. And at the time, we didn't have someone like you on Game Now to help make sure that things actually read nicely. So my one-page spread went out and it was called, by my own typo in giant font, Twin Towers, the game. Because that had just happened. And I was so embarrassed.
Okay, well, I mean, mine, I feel like mine is worse because and this is related to the topic, but because mine was a gaming knowledge thing, and because I was there already as basically a glorified copy editor who was not supposed to know anything about games and wasn't supposed to be like part of the gaming editorial, I think it was Phantasy Star Online, and it was our front like spread review.
Yep.
And the way we did the layout, you know, they wouldn't always X out the previous content in the, I think it was Quark. We weren't even at InDesign at that time.
Yeah, it was Quark.
So you would have to go in and like overwrite the previous lead game content. And I think our Phantasy Star Online review had the head, like had the little, I don't remember what it's called, like the bullet where you do the platform.
Yeah.
I think it said PlayStation 2. And I remember Tom Russo had a, like when he saw that in the magazine, he
was
so, I mean, of course, he was rightfully, as all editors in chief are, like they have a right to be super pissed when errors get through into print. And like we're all humiliated and embarrassed and like, that's our job, right? But I felt a ton of like, you know, I felt major imposter gamer shame because I'm like, oh my God, of course anyone should have known. Like, of course it's not, you know, that's not a, like, I had a lot of recriminations, and that was like, oh, and I'm trying to gain credibility as a gamer. You know, I'm trying to like prove to them that I deserve to be more editorial. And I like, I fucked this up, you know? And so that's the kind of thing that, I mean, it sounds so small now, but like,
in the moment, it doesn't feel that way. I totally get it. I mean, you're swimming among a bunch of alpha nerds, right? So it's just an unforgivable sin that you would get something so trivial as that wrong.
Yeah, I resemble that.
In the grand scheme, it doesn't matter, right? But what's that, Ethan?
I resemble that comment. I'm not sure how I feel about it. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's an example of the kind of thing that I just lived with a lot of stress. Sure.
So I got to share something with you though, Jen. This is totally relevant because I met up with Tom Russo while I was at Sega at an industry event, and I handed him my business card and it said Creative Director Sega. And he's like, wow, that's a cool title. And you know what? You had that same title, and the game that you messed up on was supposed to be on Dreamcast from Sega, but you're the one who got the creative director at Sega title. So, Tom, I love you, man, but Jen got that one right.
that's kind of like a nice symbolism that I hadn't even thought of, the whole Dreamcast thing. But yeah, like, and by the way, Tom and I mean, like, I think we're such good friends now, and we, like, everything with every person I've worked with in the entire industry, actually, because Ethan, I mean, you and I, we've been involved in drama, right?
Oh, but yeah.
It's all water under the bridge because everyone was under their own version of stress. So I had my stress, and Tom, who knows, like he probably had been in editorial meetings and knew that Next Gen was struggling, and you know, I didn't know anything about that, and so I'm like, who knows? And so, I mean, I'm just explaining, this is all a very long-winded way of saying that when I got to Ziff and I learned, and like especially Shu and Crispin and Mark, like they and Milky, I think Milky was on EGM at the time, right?
Yeah.
Like they were so different about managing editors. Like the managing editor role at Ziff was just different. And you know, it was like managing editors at Ziff were just expected. They were part of the editorial team. They were expected to write. They were part of the review crew. You know, and in my interview, like you guys asked, like I remember it was Greg Seward. He asked, like, well, what's the highest scoring combo you've ever gotten? Because I was into Tony Hawk at the time.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, what's the highest combo you've ever gotten? And I was able to tell him, honestly. And I mean, I think that kind of, I think that established a bit that, like, oh, she actually plays because we need somebody who plays. Because yeah. we have so many, this is where it's like, okay, little flex, EGM versus next gen. It's like, oh my gosh, we have 300 pages to fill. We have to have everyone on staff. Meanwhile, I'm like, wow, 300 pages. That's a big book. Because next gen had been very anemic in its later, you know, in its latest issues. Mm-hmm. And so right. like
it was a slim magazine.
It was used to, I was used to the minimum book size was 100, I think, 100 pages. Yeah. So, you know, that was a lot less content. So it was, I was just like, I was like, this is my dream. I'm like, how is our dreams coming true? Like, yeah. I'm like, wait a minute. Shu and Crispin, who have always been very nice to me, you know, like when yeah. I've met events and stuff. Then they're telling me I'm definitely going to be writing and that I will be able to write. If I want to write features, if I want to write previews, if I want to write news, I can do any of that. Like, that was pretty amazing. And they're moving to San Francisco and their managing editor. I mean, thank you, Dean Hager. Like,
yep, you stayed
whatever
in town.
Whatever life you have that you did not want to leave behind, thank you. I owe Dean a debt of gratitude. Also, because Dean had established like this role in the yep. magazine that I was able to fill. I mean, I don't even think I've ever met him in person, but
yeah, he's really, really nice guy. And he did do reviews as well. So I think that's also probably part of it is just Shu and Mark McDonald and Crispin Precedence. And everyone were used to, yes, Precedence. They were used to having the managing editor also write reviews.
Yeah. So, and then also Ziff had, I don't know if this existed back in Illinois, but they had a copy desk.
Yep. Yeah. Greg Ford was a part of that. Who eventually yeah, replaced I mean, yeah. you.
Yeah. So like I was able to focus because I mean the truth is like when you're a copy editor and when you're the main copy editor and also in charge of like producing the magazine as a whole, sometimes you can miss the forest for the trees or the trees for the forest, I guess is yep. more accurate. So like, I did just feel like the way Ziff, even though, okay, Ziff, EGM was like, oh my God, it was a 3-ring, 5-ring circus. I mean, it was, in some ways it was running much more poorly, but the structural way of the gaming group was much more like suitable to how I could do well than what I had been used to. So yeah.
That's great.
So yeah, my dreams came true and then I got to meet Ethan and Game Now survived for a long time.
27 issues, which in that era was a pretty long time.
Yeah. I mean, Game Now was great. And one of my best friends, Carrie Shepherd, was yep.
Managing
editor there. And I had worked with her too at Future.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I guess interactions with the gaming press was minimal when I was at Sega, mostly coincided with my interactions with the internal PR team. So I'm really curious to hear your perspective. How was the relationship between your magazine and the publishers back then? Did you find some try to exert undue influence more than others? Were there some that were more fun to work with or some that were less so? Really curious.
Oh, I mean, yes. Yes to all those. They were all different. I mean, and it really was similar having been at MTV before that. It was really similar to record labels and talent. Like, so at MTV and in the music industry or in probably in movies too, you call like the artists are called talent. So like, and then there's their, you know, the apparatus around them. And so it really depends on, and for in the game industry, talent are the developers, you know, so like sometimes there's overlap, but each publisher has its own personality. Each developer has its own personality, you know, and I knew this a little, obviously, in the press. But I think at Sega is where you really learn. You're like, oh my gosh, these are the rock star publishers.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the rock star, the developers. You don't talk to them. You don't make eye contact with them in a meeting, especially the Japanese. I mean, I'm jumping a little bit, but you know what I mean, Ethan, right?
Oh, absolutely. I totally do, yeah. And there was always some management of expectations there too. We had a PSP game from Planet Moon, actually, that Aaron Loeb worked on, that was based on Afterburner. And it got, I think, a 2 out of 10 from EGM. And Constantine was so upset about that that he wanted to call and just tear EGM a new asshole. And I had to, having been in that environment, say, whoa, hold on a second. 2 months ago, they gave Virtua Fighter 5 a 9.5. Let's play the long game here. Let's understand that they have an editorial voice that you have to trust, but that if we make a great game, we'll get a great review. If we make a game that's not so great, you got to let them do what they're going to do, and you don't want to get in the middle of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I was definitely less involved. That was all Shu, you know, and I think Shu... I mean, I think he had so many, like, struggles, challenges, close calls here and there, you know, with, because it's a fine line between, I mean, I feel that editorially, we always stood our ground. I don't think I could have worked for a magazine where there was any kind of, like, pay for play, you know, if any of that existed, it was very well shielded from me, and therefore I don't think it existed, because like, not calling it it's not a clown show, but it was, you know, it wasn't a well enough oiled machine to keep secrets like that. So I think that Shu protected, and everyone, we all had editorial integrity.
Yep. Oh, and Shu was great about it to the degree that, and Chris, Shu was the editor in chief at EGM.
Yep.
He I would think ensure that
so nicely.
Yeah. Well, he made sure that the travel expenses were always on Ziff Davis's dime, never on the publisher's dime. So it was a very common thing for companies like EA and Activision to pay for the travel for freelance journalists. Shu would never allow that. There was a time in which I think it was Microsoft gave every magazine a bunch of HD TVs for their desks because their system now ran in HD, and that kind of feels like a gift. And so when he got those, he just, if I remember correctly, ended up just giving them away to readers. Didn't want to have that be something that the staff had. Yeah. And that was some pretty high integrity stuff. And that's the thing that people don't understand. They see a magazine and they see a lot of video game ads, and so they just make the assumption that that means that the editors are working hand in hand with the publishers of games. And that was never the case. And we were always defended when we had to give a bad review. I had to give a Capcom game a very negative review, and they got super upset with us at the magazine because I said, don't purchase this game under any circumstances. Then they're like, you can say you don't like it, but that's going too far. And we were supported by not just Shu, but John Davison and Lee Uniac. And like, we were given the cover we needed as very vulnerable young writers to say what needed to be said.
Yeah. Oh my God. I forgot that. That rings a bell though. I mean, it is fun as an editor to read a review of a bad game. Like, we don't know, but the thing that we're, and to, maybe to write it, but the thing that also happened, you have to remember at EGM or at Ziff, is that reviewer played that game.
Yep. Like,
that is a real experience. And I, that was another thing that I just loved about working at EGM, was just like,
the love of gaming and how everyone, you know, there was always somebody, like people were always playing games all around the office.
Yes.
And it was like, you know, it was kind of like at MTV, there was always music playing around the office. And like, it was pretty fun to hear people like, my office was next to Crispin's. Sometimes you could almost just hear a score going down as Crispin was playing the game. Oh.
He'd use some four-letter words, I remember.
He's a very expressive person. I mean, he's actually a very subdued person. His personality is very subdued and very kind and nice. Yep. But certain games, I would just be like, oh, I don't want to be on the receiving end of that review.
Yes, yes.
So, but no, in terms of like working with publishers, I feel like they definitely knew that we were at least doing our best to have editorial integrity, separation from the publishing side. And I mean,
separation from the ad side as well, probably, yeah. Right?
Yes, yes, separation from that. That's what I meant. Like, because the publisher was that the head of the ads, where the editorial
said to me what
that means. And so yeah, and even like the game giveaway, you know, because one of the perks, it's not even, I mean, it's a minor perk, but like in order to review things, this is true like in movies as well, like you get to see the movie for free, or you get the game in advance, or and then you get a free copy, because like sometimes you might be reviewing that copy. And even that at EGM was like regulated in a way, yes, that it would prevent any individual from like benefiting from, oh, we got five copies of the new GTA. Like, well, those five copies went into a locked cabinet in my office with all the other games, and then we would do a like it was basically a lottery. So you couldn't be assured you were going to get the coveted thing. So it was actually a great system, because it's kind of unrealistic, and I felt this when I was getting my journalism degree, like it's kind of unrealistic to expect anybody to like not get anything free, you know, like there are some people who are like, you don't drink coffee at press conferences. If the New York Times puts out coffee for you at a press conference, you don't drink it and you bring your own lunch. And I'm like, okay, like for really long-term editorial relationships, that's probably unrealistic. But yeah, you can put things in place. And I feel like EGM and Ziff had these things in place where individuals are prevented from like getting any one thing that they want as a benefit of their editorial work.
Yeah.
I mean, that said, I will say, you know, the trips to Japan, I feel like the trips to Japan were like, if there was anything that could resemble, even if Ziff was paying, you know, even if we were paying ourselves, it was like, oh, if you got to go to Japan on work's time, that was special. Which, did you ever go, Ethan?
I went plenty of times to Japan on Sega's dime, but never on Ziff Davis's. I wasn't important enough. You were managing editor. I was a previews editor, so...
I never went.
Oh, I thought you did. Okay. TGS was a big deal for folks, but yeah.
No, I got to go to China. That was exciting. I got to go to Shanghai for a Splinter Cell game. But no, I was not important enough, Ethan. You think? Chu didn't even go.
Okay.
Why did you go to China to cover a Splinter Cell game?
Oh, that's interesting.
It was... This was such a cool trip.
Pandora Tomorrow, right?
No.
I think that was their Shanghai game.
Okay.
Or maybe it was Chaos Theory, but yeah.
No, yeah. Thank you for remembering the names, because all of that knowledge has completely been sure, filed into the memory hole of my head. But it was being developed in Ubisoft Shanghai, and it was based, it was kind of one of the levels was in the tallest at the time, I don't know if it still is, the tallest building, which was a hotel that had a very interesting atrium. And so there was a level that was in that. And so, I mean, publishers will take any excuse to bring editors on a glamorous, exciting, even if their magazine is paying for it, which we did. And it was really cool. It was during Chinese New Year. It was in January. So it was just, I think I was up on like the 80 somethingth floor of this thing. And you could see the fireworks, and the fireworks were like at my eye level. Cause I was
that high. Cool.
And in China at the time, I think they don't do this anymore for environmental reasons, but they would do fireworks every night for like 2 weeks. The problem with that trip, which is a personal story, is I found out I was pregnant like a week before going on that trip.
Oh boy.
And it was my first pregnancy, and I had such bad morning sickness, and I was hanging out, and I couldn't tell anybody about this because, again, times have changed, but I was definitely like, I can't tell anybody I'm pregnant until like basically I am, you know, have a stomach 6 inches because I'm gonna get fired. Like, I definitely had that feeling, like, nobody can know or else I will get fired. And I was with all these editors in Shanghai who were partying like you cannot believe.
Oh, drinking like you wouldn't even guess. Yeah.
So much. And I was really kind of sick, and I was having to be like, oh, you know, this is so fun. And I was like feeling like I was going to throw up the whole time. But it was still a great trip, but I didn't get to have as much fun as I probably would have. And I look back at some of the pictures, and I look like, and I actually think, you know, Carol from Ubisoft.
Yeah. Carol Kido.
Carol Kido, yeah, she was the one, she was the rep on that trip. And I think she just thinks I am the biggest stick in the mud, fuddy duddy, no fun person.
Oh.
Like, I don't think she ever would have made the connection, because I didn't, like, I don't even think I announced I was pregnant for months. You know, it was months later. And so there was no way anybody would have looked back and said, like, oh, yeah, that's why Jen wasn't fun. I just was like the unfun person on the trip, but it was okay. But yeah, that was probably my most exciting trip that I ever took with EGM.
Well, and it's interesting to look back on those days, because nowadays, and I have a daughter who just went to college, and one thing that actually her high school warned parents about is that the literal majority of students graduating now, their number one desired job is to be an influencer. Okay, so, which is very scary. And so they're like, look, talk realistically to your kids, make sure that they go to college, let them understand that this is not the type of job you're likely to get as a grown-up. But when we were in the editorial space, there was no such thing as influencers. There was no YouTube for a good part of that. And so the job of being a games journalist or being a games critic was one of those roles that was like an influencer, an ultimate dream job. To be paid for your opinion on video games? Come on.
So I know. And I actually think that that's something EGM almost, or Ziff, the game group, and John Davison, and, you know, it's almost like we cultivated that. Like John Davison's very, he's like got a good forward thinking. He's always kind of ahead of trends and stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, with the review crew and then with podcasts, and like, we got to have personalities, and we got to like kind of be ourselves and cultivate our own personalities and sort of tell our stories. Even in our bios in Review Crew, it was largely before iPhone. So like, we would have to take pictures, like to go around with a digital camera. And I was very picky about my picture. Always. I would make Damien do like no, 20 more shots, or I would make my husband sure. Nick. No, do 20 more to like, so I can get the perfect one. I would be a terrible influencer because I would constantly be, no, I need a better filter. We didn't have filters at that time. But that was something I really loved. And I loved like having people come into our, like when people would join the magazine. And you would see how they're like kind of shy at the beginning and it takes them a little while. And then they like get their voice and then they get a little more of their voice. And then, you know, that was something that I think our gaming group did well.
Oh, yeah. Well, so first of all, I remember you and a handful of others, definitely Crispin, Milky, Shu, would be recognized at E3.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like I've gotten recognized in real life at times.
Yeah, that's what, like, I'm talking about. Yeah.
No.
Oh, yeah, you're saying no. Even outside of E3. Yeah.
I've been recognized in San Francisco before. I mean, during that time. Yeah. Because, I mean, it's hard to imagine now, but like, we barely had video on the internet.
Right.
Like, just to level set, like magazines mattered and pictures in magazines mattered. Oh, it was because I was on TV. I did those occasional like terrible, terrible things on the news. Remember?
Oh, the CNN stuff, like Video Game Big Hunting and stuff. I did one of those. Yeah. So Chris, Shu would have members of the Ziff Davis press go on and talk about a hot game that just came out, and that would be like a quick thing you'd record in the city for CNN.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but one thing that's important, Chris, is that Jen and her team were at the very tip of the spear when it came to podcasts and YouTube programs. So when the transition was happening to the oneup.com platform as opposed to the magazines, Jen was at the top of that. I remember you were very heavily involved in the One Up show, which was very hard to produce. That was a little after my time.
I mean, I was not, I would not say, I mean, I wanted to be, I loved the One Up show, but I wasn't actually that involved. I was just, they would ask me to be on it now and then, but that was Jane.
Yep.
And Che.
And Ryan O'Donnell, right?
Yeah.
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 I feel like that was like Che and Jane mostly, and that was such a, and Simon Cox was,
that's right,
involved in that.
By the way, Simon Cox was an editor, a managing editor, who was so focused on aesthetic. His layouts in magazines were beautiful, but he'd use like 7-point font in white against a yellow background for a Pokemon spread, and you couldn't read it, but it looked gorgeous. So.
Oh God, that is something.
Form over function.
No, yeah. There was a whole. I have to admit or confess that I'm not a very visual person, or something, because like people would stand over the art director's back as they would put together the cover. I'm not exaggerating, like, for cumulatively hours per cover per month. Like, and Simon and John, because for the cover is really important, so they always pull in like all the opinions they can. But this was true at Future as well, Next Gen. People just stare at that cover, and like you would change a tiny little thing, like like the font size, but let's put it up by 0.1, put it up by 0.1 more, put up, or like, let's change the saturation, or let's do this. And I'd just be like, oh my God, like, give me some text to edit. That's when I would go out and like, you know, yell at editors and be like, where's your review? Give it to me now, which I, you know.
Well, with covers too, the funniest story there, was back, it was an Expert Gamer issue, so this was maybe a little bit before your time, but there was a specific issue that sold like crazy, like went 3 times the regular number of copies sold compared to anything else that year. And the distribution team was trying to understand what the hell happened, and they looked very closely at the cover, and they decided, okay, the thing that made this work was that the background is purple. And that is what made it stand out. And they became obsessed with the idea that if you have a purple background, you're going to have a better selling magazine. Never mind the fact that the actual image on the cover was Lara Croft wearing nothing but a pillow in front of her chest. And it's like, so you think it's the purple that sold that, huh?
Definitely the purple.
Oh my God. You know, Lara Croft is such, doesn't that make us all seem like innocent and super old, that Lara Croft was like racy and a sex symbol?
Yes. Yes, but also there are things that have gotten better. So I remember walking the show floor with Carrie Shepherd, and she just said to me point blank, look, the E3 you're having is totally different than the one I'm having. And she said that deliberately, just as three booth babes were walking by us. And it just, that's what it used to be. I remember there was a display where there was literally a woman with a snake in a bikini in a glass cage. And you were supposed to just take pictures of her and gawk at her. And that stuff doesn't exist anymore, fortunately.
You don't think really? That exists at TGS?
Oh, maybe at TGS. Yeah, yeah. But not in U.S. Events. It's not, certainly not at GDC. Well, what about,
yeah, I mean, not at GDC. I haven't been to PAX in a while, probably less so, but I'll bet there's still some remnants of booth babe culture alive and well at consumer shows.
I think there's still, I mean, I think that what I have observed, and I feel like the tide was just barely starting to change during the end of my editorial career. Like, I think that the younger generation of women grew up less limited by these views of themselves. And so they were just like, because I remember I actually got in trouble, or like young women would like talk to me kind of like, what are you doing? Like, why are you letting them run these ads? You know, and like at events and things, like younger women, and I'd be kind of like, you're right. And I felt kind of like out of it in a way. And then of course, like, oh yeah, that's true. And I mean, this probably makes me sound like, I mean, like it makes me sound like I'm a dumb person or like I wasn't paying attention. No, I absolutely was paying attention. But I think when you're fighting for your life and like proving every yeah. day that you deserve to even be in the same room, because I mean, that is a thing which was generally true throughout my career in tech, is that like often you're actually not invited to the meetings. You have to kind of invite yourself to the meetings. And then when you're in the meetings, you have to actually like sit at the table and like maybe even say things you don't want to, like you have to kind of insert yourself to even be taken seriously at all, you know? And so I think I spent so many years doing that I didn't have time to worry about the dead or alive girls or whatever, you know, like,
yeah.
Like, or the booth babes. I was actually like, hey, the booth babes are nice. They're other women who are here. Like, they're nice to me. I'm happy there
are
other women here, you know? And the PR, like PR people were often women.
Well, so, and connecting all of the dots here with Sega and Ziff Davis. And I remember there was a notorious ad that ran in EGM for Sega Saturn, which had a picture of a naked woman that was spread out on a red backdrop. And her privates were covered by pictures of game clips from Sega Saturn games. And the ad was, these graphics are so good, you never even notice there is a naked woman behind the pictures.
Oh, all the ads, like the ads, I ever since, you know, that girl at some event like took a magazine and said, like, you think we're supposed to take you seriously with it? And I was ever since then, I was like, okay, I see them definitely different. I think I had just blurted out myself because I'm like, but at Sega, I will say, I mean, this is a thing about the Japanese cultural divide. Like, the sexism was way, and I mean, way more intense at Sega than in my, like, that made EGM on its worst day, like its worst Sean Baby, like, like sexist joke. It made it seem like the rainbow, you know, woke coalition. Like, because Sega being a Japanese company, and I mean, I don't think, I'm just saying culturally, they, I don't think women are like in boardrooms, or at least at our moment, I felt like from a corporate sense, like to sit in a room with them, my job was to sit in a room with them and try to tell them how to make their games more appealing to white moms like me. I mean, that was a rough, that was a rough position to be in. And when you add, like, I think at one point, one of them actually like mimed boobs, like while talking in Japanese about how he wasn't going to listen to the things I was saying. Like, I think he used sign language to be like, I'm not listening to somebody with boobs. I think that happened. That actually happened. And at the same time, I was kind of like, you know what? Nobody really wants to hear what I think. So, like, why am I mean, it's not why am I here, but I felt like I had a very challenging role at that moment.
But at the same, I totally hear what you're saying, and it's really disappointing that that happened. But also, you were invaluable when it came to being a different voice, because everyone else's voice sounded the same. And so when it came to the influx of, say, all these Wii games, and when we had licenses that I didn't understand, I remember very distinctly we were in negotiations for the Twilight license, and I was pitching stuff like, oh, we can have a motorcycle sequence and we can have fighting mechanics. And you were the one, along with Michelle, who's been on our show before as well, who pushed back and said, no, 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 that's not what the audience of Twilight wants. They want something that is more narrative driven. And I was completely off. We didn't get the license. It went to Konami instead, but they made a trivia game out of it, which is smart. I didn't know what I was talking about because I didn't understand that audience. I didn't understand the Wii audience.
Yeah, we were all trying. That was such a, actually, I think about that time a lot, and I think about what we were trying to do, and I feel a sense of like just such a so many missed opportunities, because I mean, personally, ever since I left the industry, and since like casual games kind of imploded or became replaced by iPhone, like I feel like we missed. I still think back to, like, I mean, Ethan, your favorite Super Monkey Ball, it could have been tweaked just a little to make it like so much more accessible.
Yep.
And that was just not possible the way the development process and the way Sega as a publisher worked. Like, it would have required too much thinking out of the box.
Yeah.
But I kind of, like, I feel sad that we didn't get out of the box. Because what happened is they threw away the box for casual games.
Mm-hmm.
And now I don't play games anymore. And I don't have time to play games. And I always am thinking, I'm like, oh, I dreamed of a different world where I'd have three kids and I'd be playing games with them in a different way. And my kids play games, but they play games in a sort of more of a hardcore way. You know, what we would call a hardcore way. And sometimes I can like get into that, but Roblox, they have somehow Roblox and Dress to Impress, like, and all their other like crazy little mini meta, whatever those games are within Roblox. I mean, they nailed it.
I heard a crazy stat, like Roblox has more daily users than Xbox has. Over all,
oh, yeah, 100%.
And the
which
girls,
is crazy.
The girls with games like Dress to Impress, or there's like one called, I think it's called Adopt Me.
Yeah. Well, again, those would be the type of games that you back in the day, because we sat right next to each other. We were both creative directors. You would have recognized the value of those, where that would have just been hard for me to see.
Dreamed of this, and I feel like Michelle and I probably did. We probably were saying, like, so for, you know, Daisy Fuentes or whatever, let's do it. It was probably similar to Dress to Impress, like let's let girls pick their clothes, or let's let this, you know, let's do that or whatever. And I mean, not literally for Daisy Fuentes. That was a joke. Nobody laughed.
Yeah,
that was a joke. It was just not. It was not within the framework of a console.
Yeah.
It was too. It's like too much. I guess it costs too much money to take those kind of chances.
You know, and also the industry. It was a little premature as well, insofar as the rise of the social network hadn't really happened. So my opinion on Roblox is that it's basically social. It's a social network first and foremost, and then happens to have games that people play. But it's the kids' version of Facebook, and that's why it's so huge.
Yeah. We were also dealing with retail.
We were dealing with, remember, we were like, oh, you know, we have to get the moms to go into the store and buy the games, and that's a whole other thing that doesn't exist now. So, but
And one thing I want to make clear, I know that it would certainly have been more challenging to be a female than a male in this period of time in the games industry. At the same time, you had qualifications and experiences that went well beyond just, oh, you are the mom or the girl gamer. You loved BioWare games. I remember you were the first in our office to sit down with your brand new laptop and play Dragon Age 1. And I was so jealous of that. And you also got opportunities to provide feedback to Obsidian Games and stuff like that. So I just want to make clear that, and it was the same thing in EGM as well. You were doing reviews of all sorts of games, including core games, which you deeply understood and helped a lot of people connect with or avoid if they were bad. And I just want to make that clear, because so much of what we've talked about leading up to this is the stuff that you've done that was more gendered work, but that is not the limit by any stretch of what you were contributing to or doing.
Thank you for reminding me about that, because it's not something I think about all the time. But yeah, it's true that you know, part of my life, and like before I worked in games, and the reason I was drawn to even applying at Next Gen was because after being in the music industry, which was so like regimented, and the way they did things was so strict and not a lot of room for creativity, I saw games as this cool like frontier of creativity. And I discovered PC games early on, you know, and that's how my husband Nick, like, he kind of taught me, like, he taught me to play Half-Life. We played EverQuest together, and then we played role-playing games, you know. And then when I was unemployed for that long year, actually, it was Nick who told me, he was like, you know, just enjoy playing games. Like, you have the time, and you're never going to have this time again. And he was so right. He's like, just play what you feel. And I got into Tony Hawk, and I got into SSX Tricky.
Oh, I love that game. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I played those games, and I played Neverwinter Nights. That was the era. That was the era of my unemployment. And it turned out that time I spent on those games is what allowed me, when the magical moment of EGM moving to town, I was quite up on my, I was a serious gamer, you know, I mean, I really was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I do love games. I actually dream of having time to play games again. Have either of you been to the Sphere in Las Vegas?
No, I've only seen pictures.
Chris? I guess I have.
I saw you two there. It was pretty awesome.
Oh, awesome.
I wish I had seen you two. I went to this like EDM thing run by Insomniac, and it was like the first half of it felt like it was just all Game of Thrones. But there was this moment where I had this EverQuest flashback. And I mean, I'm just saying, like, this is how far back my knowledge goes. Because I was like, oh my God. I was remembering, like, almost it would look like 8-bit graphics at this point, you know? And I was imagining an MMORPG, like, someday. When I saw at the Sphere the graphics and how immersive it was, where you could really be in an environment and, like, looking all around you. I mean, I've done a little bit of VR with Oculus and whatever, and that's cool. But I think I'm still dreaming of the world where EverQuest or World of Warcraft is very immersive
you know, and the fact that I was able to live in that world back in the 90s mm-hmm. and early 2000s when it was almost what would be the equivalent of 8-bit graphics now. The idea that you could have like real dragons flying around and you could actually feel yourself with the weapons and stuff. Like, I guess I still have that nerd component to me where I'll go right back in it. And I will have my little Black Mirror, like headset thing, you know, the little thing that yep. they have in there. And I will be very happy to go back into my, wizards and warlocks, and I was a paladin in EverQuest.
Well, Chris and I have we've talked a lot about the fact that the market is so big now that games mean different things to different people and can appeal to so many more people than back when we were writing about them. So I still look at games as novels or storybooks, and I want to be by myself doing it and finish the story and go to the next book. Whereas people, as Chris was saying, with Roblox, that's social media that is ordered play patterns. So you can do things alongside your friends and keep up with them conversationally and spend a little bit of money to, you know, get some exciting things within the game as well. You're talking about the advancement of MMO and VR, and I think that that is something a lot of people dream of. And we're looking at, like, how many gamers there are globally right now. I did look that up. It's 3.3 billion right now. That's a lot different than it was 20 years ago when we were writing for magazines.
I mean, well, so much different. And that probably includes everyone. Do you think that includes like Wordle?
Yeah. Everyone oh yeah. It includes everyone. Yeah, yeah.
It's mostly mobile. More than half is mobile.
Spelling Bee on New York Times, which, by the way, I mean, this is another thing where I feel like Michelle and you and I dreamed of this kind of thing where we would have like a connected puzzle experience where yeah. our moms, we could play with our moms and our dads and our kids, and like it might be asynchronous. You know, I mean, we definitely had all the notions. We just weren't in a position where it could come together, you know, but we did try.
Yes. And the more things change, the more they stay the same. I just got a picture from my daughter. She's out in Ohio right now in college, but she said it was Mario Party night, and she showed a picture, and sure enough, all of her girlfriends were sitting there, five of them playing Mario Kart and Mario Party. But the picture she showed was they were sitting all around the tiny Switch 2 screen. Not a uh-huh. television, but this microscopic little screen.
Ethan, wait, your daughter? Was that like a rebellious moment? Because I feel like you are the person who advocated most for, you have been, right? That's like...
Oh, for like big screen experiences? Yeah.
No, you're the one who docked your Switch. And I feel like that's half of your Facebook posts were talking about how great it is to dock your Switch and play on the big screen and yeah. move seamlessly back and forth with your saved game, right? Am I right?
Totally. But that is the ritual of my generation. Her generation doesn't care about the big screen TV at all.
That's amazing, but I love that she is your daughter and she's playing on Switch. So
yes, that is absolutely yeah, like father, like daughter for sure. But one last thing I wanted to cover: after Sega, you went on to work at GamesBeat, which was kind of more industry focused games editorial. I remember Dean Takahashi was the editor in chief there. Is that right?
Yeah, well, Shu was the editor.
Oh, right.
When I came. And then a month after I was there, and I think literally as soon as he cashed that referral bonus check, he told me, for me, he was like, so Jen, I remember he pulled me aside. He's like, Jen, hate to tell you, but I'm bailing. So Shu took off. That's one of those inside baseball moments where you're like, yeah. Okay, thanks, Shu, because he had recruited me really heavily because I hadn't been working and I had three kids and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so overwhelmed and like working is hard. He recruited me so hard. Then he left. But yeah, I was there for about a year and I worked with Dean.
Dean, the machine, Takahashi. Yeah,
who had his own embarrassing Cuphead moment, if you remember.
No, remind me.
He played Cuphead in front of journalists, and he played so badly that it became a meme online. Like, he died on the first level on the easiest thing, and people were like, oh, this guy doesn't know how to play video games.
That game is way too hard.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It wasn't way too hard.
I love the look of it. It was kind of one of my childhood dreams of, like, literally playing a cartoon, which is kind of what I always wanted as a kid. And I was so frustrated by that game because it's so visually arresting and amazing, but it is so punishing and unfun for me. And I'm a semi-competent gamer. They missed so many, wowing so many people just because it was so hard, I think.
Well, this is the thing, though, Chris, is that the hardcore gamers always assume that the game journalists are master gamers. And I remember back when Xbox Live launched, we were encouraged to use handles that referenced our magazines. So I was Ethan Game Now, and I went into this motorcycle game. It was one of the launch games for Xbox. And people were asking in chat, are you really writing for this magazine? I'm like, yeah, it's really me. And they're like, cool, cool. And they just smoke me. And I come in like eighth place. And I remember one of the guys saying, not to me, but to one of their buddies, nah, it wasn't really him.
I remember playing Splinter Cell on Xbox Live and just having the kids be like a bit mean. Well, we all know Xbox Live. I don't know. Is Xbox Live still like that? I mean, the culture there was not a
healthy one.
Not one of social emotional well-being. It doesn't all have to be the cesspool of the internet. But since we grew up in the cesspool of the internet.
Yeah.
Which was video game journalism at the advent of community online, which I think is safe to say, that we saw the dark side really early. And yeah. No, you know what else I remember? You just reminded me. I was leaving right as Gamergate was starting.
Oh, okay.
I'm having a little PTSD even thinking about it because I feel like I dodged a bullet. I left right before all that.
I remember just as a person on social media trying to correct the record when I'd see someone say something that I knew was wrong about the way the editorial space worked. And I'd be like, no, they're actually super straight-laced about everything from who pays for the travel to food, all the things we talked about earlier. But no one wanted to hear that. Even though I came from the space and I knew what I was talking about, they only wanted to attack and believe in the nonsense stories they heard from people who were never in editorial to begin with.
I mean, there was blood in the water, you know, and I was really, and also, I mean, remember, like, I don't know if you're up on this, but like, I had a stalker. Like an actual stalker at EGM.
That's horrible. And I know there was another female editor prior to you that had that same problem that had to be walked to her car.
Yeah. And like I had had, you know, I remember like Don Davison was like, you know, we're going to report it to the FBI because like it's interstate and stuff. And they didn't have any way of dealing with that. They probably still don't, in fact. Or if they did, it's probably gone now. But
yeah.
It was scary to me, like actually scary. So that was during the EGM days. So when Gamergate and the whole doxing thing started to happen for those women, I was just like, get me away from this industry. You know, that I would say that like, and I had like three small kids at the time.
Yeah.
I was just like, I'm out. I'm just out. I don't want this, you know, and all I could remember was, and you know, for my version was very light when you think about it, like, okay, a little bit of stalking, a little bit of contacting my family. Okay, fine. You know, a little bit of FBI, but the part that hurt me was all the like NeoGAF, remember? And like,
oh yeah.
Like, I think it was like 4chan. There was some stuff where it was like mean, really mean stuff that people said about me.
Yeah, people who were jealous of the kind of job you were able to land that they couldn't.
Or, like,
hate women, you know, and yep. want to like get into it with other people who hate women. But when that got to be like beyond toxic, I mean, I already was like busy as a mom, but yeah. I have to say, I kind of was like, okay, guess what, guys? I'm really busy as a mom now. Like I had dipped my toe in Twitter before then, but then I was like, I'm 100% out of Twitter, even though I feel like I kind of missed out on some of the, like, the trends, you know, and the way culture was moving, because of that, but I couldn't do it. But that was like where my career, you know, the VentureBeat, GamesBeat thing was right at the border of the culture. And I mean, Gamergate was, I would say, a launching of our culture into this new era that we've been in, which is like nobody's safe online, you know, and opinions like the canceling and the sort of like the tempest in a teapot every day about yes. something that actually doesn't affect any of our personal, like our one-to-one relationships with anybody, you know. And I mean, that's actually really hard.
And I think a big part of it is just the unfortunate and inevitable piece that comes with massive growth. When we say 3.3 billion gamers, that means it's the biggest tent you can possibly imagine. But I guess I've just felt like I have ultimately experimented with different things, multiplayer games, mobile games, but ultimately I've come back to just playing exactly the same type of games I played 20 years ago, often replaying games from 20 years ago, and talking to the same people that I used to talk to about those things today, and kind of leaving it at that. So I have kind of just gone down the same path I've been on since I was 10. And that for me is what's worked out. Just single player story driven games and talking to people about that after playing, not while I'm playing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I need to get back to, I like that idea of getting back to like your heart, you know, where does your heart lead you in games? Because, there are some times, I mean, I'm not, you know, I had my first kid. You and I both had our first kid go to college. So we still have kids and kids need stuff. But like even having one kid leave, you can kind of glimpse like, oh, maybe I do get my evenings back, you know, again.
Yep.
Or
yep.
Weekends. My weekends are going to be wide open. And I have said to Nick sometimes, I'm like, oh, no, it might be fun. That's why I am fantasizing about like a new EverQuest experience, you know, a new World of Warcraft experience.
Jump into something new that reminds you of what you love so much back when you truly loved games and it was so important to you that you jumped into the industry itself.
Yeah. Yeah. But for me, I will say even my husband doesn't agree because he's like you. He's like, I don't want to be social. But if I press, he wants to be social with his close friends, or like if it gets me playing games, like that's actually one of the most fun activities we can do together. So, so there's that. And then, yeah, I mean, I guess there's still hope. I always still dream of having time to play games again. And, let's hope that happens.
Well, and going back to our origins, when I sit and talk to you or talk to Chris, we haven't worked all together in a decade plus. And yet it feels like it was just yesterday. Conversation like this feels like we're just sitting around the table drinking coffee. And that's what I love. It really feels like no time at all has passed. And I hope our audience, when you're listening to this, feel the same way. And Jen, I just want to thank you for coming on board. It was so fun to catch up. This was really a great experience to just look at what we all were doing back in the day and just think about how much that has formed and shaped us all.
Well, thanks. I mean, Ethan and Chris, I want to say thanks for even thinking of having me on. But Ethan, in particular, like, you helped me get that job at Sega, and that was really, like, I mean, at the time I called it a lifeboat, which isn't actually, I mean, it was, it was, because things were going away in magazines. But what I didn't realize was how fun it would be to sit next to you every day and like just, I mean, you made that job really, really fun. So
that's so nice to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I often think about, I'm like, oh my God, I really like whenever I hear your voice, I'm like, oh my God, it was so fun sitting next to Ethan and just like we would just talk all day.
Yep. And sometimes we'd strong agree, sometimes we'd hard disagree, and that was all part of the fun.
Yeah. It was
great. So thank you for giving me that experience and for advocating for me to in that job, because it was really, really great. And all the people I met there were also just great. So
it was nice to mostly observe the trip down memory lane. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thanks everyone for listening. We'll catch you next week.
Ciao.